So usually when I do both of these in the same talk, the pointed cluster observations get short shrift, and I get stuck on the Nelema was here for the last instance of this when I spoke at Stanford. I barely got to the cluster stuff. So I'm starting with the cluster stuff, and we'll see if I get to the stuff. Apparently, we're all in agreement anyway, so it's OK. So yeah, this is the SEA. This is the SEA collaboration. We've got a lot of grad students who've just finished or are about to finish. And so we've got a couple of young ones entering at the bottom. It's has been a top-heavy project for a while. There are a couple postdocs. We're getting another postdoc next year. It's largely in Chicago and Alabama and Columbia. Just so you know, the SEA is over here. It's in sort of central California on the Nevada border. It's an 8-element interferometer. They're 3.5-meter telescopes. The size of the dishes is chosen to match their sensitivity to this angular scale of clusters. You have to choose your filtering carefully with an interferometer, and they're optimized for clusters. We have a large bandwidth, and as I said, we have in the 8 gigahertz, we have 256 channels with a digital correlator. Typically, we arrange the array with 6 compact antennas, and then 2, those are sensitive to clusters, or CMB anisotropy, and 2 outriggers that allow us to detect point sources that contaminate our emission, contaminate our observations. We have 2 frequencies, 1 centimeter and 3 millimeters, or 30 and 90 gigahertz. And we've been running since late 2005. Most of the first couple years were spent doing a 6-square degree cluster search when that was, you know, something that was impressive. Now it takes SPT a couple minutes to do a 6-degree survey, and a CMB anisotropy measurement that I may get to talk about. Since about September 2007, we focused on pointed cluster observations, clusters that we already know about. We've observed more than 100 of them by now, and this is the largest sample of pointed cluster observations so far. Although, you know, if you start counting SE detected clusters, then that may not be the case. An interesting development in the SEA is that last summer we moved this array up a nearby mountain to join with KARMA. KARMA is an array of 15 telescopes, 6 10-meter and 9 6-meter dishes. They used to be OVRO and BIMA. And so in the plan is that eventually the SEA would be fully become part of KARMA, and we'll have a 23-element heterogeneous array. It would be very good for mapping star-forming regions and mapping extragalactic CO and things like that, and also for SE interferometry. The first experiment of using the SEA plus KARMA dishes is actually going to happen in the end of the summer. We're waiting on the new KARMA correlator, but the plan is to take the 6 10-meter dishes and our small dishes. That's about 70% of the total collecting area of KARMA. So we're getting most of the sensitivity, and do 14-element SE interferometry. And with that combination, we should have pretty good brightness sensitivity on fine scales, 10 arc seconds to 45 arc seconds. And so we will do resolved imaging of clusters in this experiment in a way that hasn't been done much before, except that Brian is going to show you another example of it today. Are you talking today, Brian? Yeah. Tomorrow. All right. Well, anyway. The plan is to start doing detailed cluster investigations with this array. I think an interesting thing to note is that as of last proposal period, we were giving away about a week of SEA time in the current coming semester. Next fall, or this fall, the SEA will be open to external proposals just like the rest of KARMA. And so anyone in this room will now be able to propose their own SE cluster observations for whatever object they want, assuming they can get time from the KARMA TAC. And this is a new development in this field. In the past, all SE observations have been, you know, controlled by the institution that built the instrument. And this is now going to become available to everyone. And it's going to be another year or two, depending on a correlator upgrade, before we can do full 23-element interferometry. So what can we do with this array? As I said, we're going to do detailed cluster imaging. This is an example. If I take one of Daisuke's simulations, or if, as the case may be, Eric Leach takes one of Daisuke's simulations, and we observe it with reasonable SEA integration time, The current 30 gigahertz configuration gives us a pretty unresolved blob. Basically, we recover the SE flux, but that's about all we can say. If we add in our second band, which gives us higher angular resolution, we start to see some structure. But when we add in the rest of Karma, you see that we're actually getting pretty high dynamic range imaging of the cluster. You can see that we clearly resolve the cores, and we reproduce this sort of wispy structure here and here. And so we have the prospect of actually learning about the details of the SC signal in the clusters. What's that? Oh, that's I think that's 8 days, something like that. It's a pretty typical cluster observing period. It's not 8 full days. It's 8 tracks, maybe 10, but I can't remember. What's that? With Karma plus SEA, the full, yeah. Yeah, that concerns me a little bit. I wonder about that, but I don't know what to say. But yes, that is a pretty well-masked cluster. Certainly, we've observed many clusters or a few clusters at that level. I think many is fair to say, of order 8. But they do take a while. It's just hard for me to verify, given that we'll be adding a factor of 10 in collecting area. You know, I can't be certain that this may be a little bit misscaled, or the normalization of Y in this map may not be fair for the observations. But anyway, so why are we still messing with this array in the era when we have ACT and SPP? Well, I think the thing we're trying to do with the SEA and SEA plus Karma is to understand clusters in detail. The South Pole Telescope and ACT will assemble huge samples of clusters, and it will take a very long time to follow them up. And if you want to understand them in any great detail, you want to look at them in lots of different ways and compare answers. You'd also like higher angular resolution. There's nothing you can do to improve the resolution of SPP and ACT. And so one thing we can do with the interferometers is push to finer scales. We can also construct, you know, now, samples, large samples of clusters with lots of corroborating information from other wavelengths. And that's what we're spending a lot of our time doing. One of our big projects is something called LOCUS, the Local Cluster Substructure Survey, which is PI'd by Graham Smith, who just sent an email this morning saying he survived the London Marathon. The idea is to construct a morphologically unbiased sample of clusters. They're X-ray selected, but the idea is to select deep enough in LX that you see both merging systems and cool core systems and things that are completely smooth and undisturbed in a fairly narrow redshift slice. And the project combines all of these things. These are predominantly mass and ICM tracers, and these are cluster member galaxy tracers. I'm going to focus on the first half of these. But certainly, there are people even in this room who have a lot of interest in the second half. So the status is that the SEA has observed about close to 70 of these clusters to date. About 50 have X-ray, 40 of them have weak lensing measurements, 50 have strong lensing from HST. This is just a gallery of LOCUS members. On the fainter ones, the typical noise is of order 10 micro K. The things we're trying to do, the primary things we hope to get out of LOCUS and SEA, are to measure scaling relations and really understand them. A fundamental thing for using clusters for cosmology is to understand the relationship between mass and Y and the systematics in that relationship. And there's really not a lot of observational data on that so far. And so we're going to measure, I'll show you the mass-Y relationship, on a range of scales, see what about the cluster merger state or other morphological information affects that relationship. Measure, try and directly constrain the hydrostatic mass bias by comparing hydrostatic mass estimates and the lensing measurements we have. And then provide feedback to people who simulate clusters in the hope of improving those simulations and making them more consistent with reality. So I'll show a couple different results here. One is just an ICM gas comparison between X-ray and SC. And then one is an actual Y mass scaling relation. which, as Sue was discussing yesterday, is not something that we have a lot of data on. So in Daisuke's talk yesterday, he introduced YX briefly. A couple of years ago now, Andrei Kravtsov, Alexei Yukunin, and Daisuke had a paper where they introduced something called YX. And it's supposed to be an X-ray analog for the SD signal, something that you can easily get right out of the X-ray data that should be tightly correlated with mass. He showed exactly this plot, a very tight relationship between YX and mass in the simulations. I shouldn't touch the screen, apparently. Sorry, folks. I hope none of you throws up. yeah. And so one of the first locus papers to come out was an analysis of 35 clusters observed with XMM. And they investigated the relationship between YX and hydrostatic mass. So they already had YX calculated. And since we had observed many of these with the SEA, all the ones that were available to us, we thought sort of as a verification of our analysis and hopefully something interesting would come out of it, we would compare YX and YSC. And I must say that when I was writing the code to make this plot, I had no expectation that it would turn out to be at all correlated. But this is the result. We have 26 clusters plotted here. There are a couple more I can add now. Each one is plotted three times at three different overdensities. This is at R500, R1000, and R2500. Those are measured from the X-ray. We just use their radii so that we're directly comparing like with like. And you can see that there's actually very little scatter between these two ICM tracers. If you look very closely, you might also notice that the blue points, the R500 measurements, are basically centered on this line of, you know, YX equals YSZ. But by the time you get to the red, that's not the case anymore. I should just note that if you take each radius individually and you measure the intrinsic scatter in this relationship, it's actually fairly close to the 8% that Daisuke is quoting in his paper between Y and M. So this is about as good as we could hope to do. These two numbers aren't statistically significantly different. It's a little more than one sigma. It's just that the constraints at R500 are weaker, so it's harder to measure the intrinsic scatter. But as I said, this is not statistically different than this. It's just that the error bars are much larger here, so it's harder to constrain the intrinsic scatter. But in any case, I mean, 8 times square root 2 is, you know, this is in the right ballpark, and I'm surprised to have it in the right ballpark, and pleasantly surprised. I think that's fair. Yes. So perhaps this is an upper limit on the. Perhaps this says very little about the correlation with mass. But I think that going into this, I had no expectation that our y's would be correlated with anything. That's separated. So that's this is a fairly robust estimator of the intrinsic scatter after you've gotten rid of the noise.
That's absolutely
without the noise. Yes. I played around a lot with trying to find an estimator for this. This comes from a paper by Benjamin Wiener from 2006 and was originally motivated by fundamental plane maps.
So how do you actually measure YSC?
How are we measuring YSC? So we take our interferometer observations. They are the Fourier transform of the cluster signal. And to recover Y at a given radius in real space, we fit the visibilities to the Fourier transform of a universal pressure profile. And that pressure profile is motivated by Daisuke simulations. It was tested against X-ray observations and then tested by us to the best of our abilities against SC observations in a paper by Tony Yun.
You don't really measure by SC, you really find the best fit to a profile.
Yes, and I'm going to, when we get to the end of this section, I'm going to comment on that there's a reason to have some questions about that. So let me get back to that.
How do you know R500?
R500 and all the over NC radii come from the X-ray.
From X-ray.
Yes. Because we need to measure both at the same frequency. As I was saying, the normalization here is drifting a bit. All of these have a slope consistent with unity, but the normalization is drifting. As you get smaller radii, there's becoming an excess of SZ over X-ray. And you can quantify this. If you look at the normalization of basically the ratio of YSZ to YX at each radius, it's about 5% excess at the R500, and it's about 30% excess at R2500. And this is a little bit surprising. Basically, this ratio is something like the mass-weighted temperature over the emission-weighted temperature. But the prescription for YX is to cut the core. And so we don't really expect this sort of evolution. In dice case simulations, he doesn't reproduce it. But it is what we observe. You can ask, can we find a physical origin for this by breaking up our sample of 26 into subsamples? And so one of the things you look at is cool core clusters versus non-cool core. So this is the same plot again. I'm going to drop the error bars and just identify cool core and non-cool core clusters. And so if you look here, it's not, I don't know how easy it is to see, but there's no statistically significant difference between the two populations in this, for this breakdown. There are symbols of both kinds on both sides of the mean for each radius. You can also break it down into relaxed and unrelaxed clusters. And this is breaking it down at each radius. I don't know how easy it is to see. You can see the cyan points tend to be up there, and the black points tend to be down there. This is the same symbols I used in the previous plot. There is a difference here. And the difference is that the unrelaxed clusters tend to be higher than the relaxed ones. But if you want to look at where the evolution's coming from, it turns out that this evolution is actually coming from the relaxed clusters. So the unrelaxed clusters have a fairly constant excess with radius. But the relaxed clusters are evolving quite strongly by about 35% over the range of radii we're looking at. And so this may be telling us something interesting about the physics of these clusters. It may also be telling us that the profile we're using doesn't as faithfully represent the SZ in relaxed clusters as it does in unrelaxed, or that the parameters we're using are more appropriate for unrelaxed clusters than they are for relaxed clusters. I will say that we have varied the parameters somewhat to try and investigate this, and that we weren't able to make this effect go away. But I would not, we are unable, because we don't have the data to constrain the parameters from, we can't constrain the profile from our data alone, so we can't really marginalize over them. We can only vary them and look at them in more detail. And this is sort of what's hanging up this investigation, is trying to figure out whether we're learning physics or whether we're learning about our modeling or what the mixture of those two things is. They are spherical because, given the parameter degeneracies, that is a less divergent thing. The integrating the cylinder, it isn't as well constrained.
Can I ask you again the question, how do you model exactly? You first fit a beta profile to the X?
No, no beta profile. No. Okay. Absolutely not. No.
Okay, so basically, but you fit an amplitude to the SZ.
No. I'll tell you how we do this. Okay. The X-ray and SZ are entirely independent. They never see each other. They've never met. They just appeared on a plot. The X-ray are modeled basically with the Clinton model, and YX is calculated in that way. The SZ is modeled with basically a two-parameter fit. We have a profile shape. We allow its scale and normalization to vary, and we fit the cluster with that, jointly fitting with all the radio sources that appear in the field, but anyway. And so the profile is a three-parameter three constrained parameter profile, we have three fixed parameters that describe the shape of the profile. And this is what I was talking about, that we are varying. It's just hard to explore the full space of this. The data absolutely do not provide the power to constrain that on their own. So we have to take guidance from simulations at some level.
And you get your starting shape exclusively from simulations?
We get our starting shape from simulations, but in Daisuke's paper where he worked this out, he has he has two different sets of parameters, one which is normalized from the one is set from the simulations, and one is set from X-ray observations. And so we're taking the ones that are guided by the X-ray pressure profile. So anyway, I think that at the very least, this demonstrates that that we're not insane, that we're getting Ys out of our data that have some bit relationship to reality. They're at least well correlated with X-rays. And so we can move on from there to looking at Y and M, which is, John, yes?
Yeah, I was going to your shortest baselines, where do they go out to typically on this?
Our shortest baselines, well past here.
Well past Earth.
Yeah, 350 lambda is, you know, 10 arc minutes on the sky or something like that. So. 0.15, 0.3.
Can you do this plot sort of
divergent? We can, but it's a very narrow slice, right? 0.15, 0.3 is not very wide.
So there is one possibility that the effect of substruction that they ignore in multiple models is more important than small radius, and that would bias the X-ray basically higher. So if you have confidence in X-ray.
That's the opposite.
That's going to increase by X, right? Therefore, the question is which radius is the more important, is that the more important, larger radius or smaller radius? But that's one bias. So there's one other thing: some of argued that relaxed clusters correlate with cool core clusters, and so the question is how do you define relaxed and cool core in this thing? Is it just cooling time? All of the cool core clusters,
according to the definitions of these samples, all of the cool core clusters are in the relaxed sample here. But there are more relaxed clusters than just the cool core one. And the relaxed, unrelaxed, it's cooling time for the cool core, and it's measured from the X-ray. The relaxed, unrelaxed dichotomy is an X-ray morphological selection. It's certainly not coming from the SC. So on to MY. As I said, this is a key ingredient for doing cluster cosmology, doing cosmology with SC-detected clusters. And we haven't yet exactly mapped out how this is going to work. One important thing is that everything relies on a low mass a low scatter proxy for the mass. The theory is that Y is such a proxy, but again, this isn't constrained. It came up yesterday that perhaps the only sort of uniformly selected scaling relation between mass and Y is in our paper from last year. It seems longer ago than that. Bonamente et al., and it was taking 38 clusters from the predecessors of the SDA, the OVRO and BIMA arrays, comparing Y from SC plus X-ray, this was discussed yesterday by Shua, versus an X-ray hydrostatic mass. And so it's all done at R2500. The measurement errors are large enough that you can't actually constrain this. Intrinsics scatter very well, and there's certainly a possible correlation between this and this, since they're very closely related. And in any case, there's no way to measure the difference between hydrostatic mass and true mass when you're using hydrostatic mass. So the idea with LOCUST is that we would use ultimately weak and strong lensing, initially weak and strong lensing separately, to constrain mass-Y relationship. And if we take the X-ray data that we also have in the CAN, in principle, we can examine mass Y versus radius. We can look at both hydrostatic and lensing mass measurements and compare them and look for the mass bias. We can check self-similarity, not just that there's a scaling relation, but whether or not it's self-similar. And we can measure the scatter directly. Last time I gave this talk, I didn't have this data. And so I was showing from a paper of disturbed looking clusters that Okabe and Ohmatsu put out with Subaru data. I was showing what our data should look like when they were finished with the analysis. But now I do have it. Very happily, it appeared about a month ago. And so this is an example of the data quality. This is the convergence map. You can see there's a very significant detection of mass concentration there. This is a radial profile fit. In general, what they tried to do was fit both a singular isothermal sphere with a core and an NFW profile to the clusters. You can see the NFW seems to be doing better in this case. In general, it does. This is great. So Okabe et al., it's on ESTRPH. It's been submitted to the PSJ. There's 30 clusters in their sample. 22 of them have mass profiles that are well fit by NFW. So these are all radio profile fits that I'll be comparing to. The typical precision of these sort of state-of-the-art weak lensing measurements is delta M over M of about 15% to 50%, as depending on what overdensity radius you're looking at and the cluster you have, the signal noise of the cluster you're looking at. This is the virial radius for the average density of the sample. And so you can see that we could push these all the way out to near the virial radius. The best signal to noise is between about R2500 and R500 for most clusters. Unfortunately, that's well matched to what the SEA is sensitive to. And so the SEA has observed all 30 of these clusters. 25 of them are well detected. 3 are contaminated by radio emission, and 2 of them are not real high mass clusters. They're oddballs, and you could read the Subaru paper to understand what they are. Of these, 18 have NFW fits, and so in the months since this paper's appeared, this is what we have on hand. To fit to, and so I'm going to show you a scaling relation for 18 clusters between Y and weak lensing mass, and this is the first such measurement as far as I know. So this is the self-similar scaling. The prediction for the scaling between Y and mass under the assumptions of self-similarity are as follows. Note that the overdensity at which you do this matters, and so if you plot two overdensities on the same plot as I'm about to, there should be a vertical shift between them. And so here you go. This is 18 clusters, each one plotted twice, as is my habit. It's not obvious how much correlation there is there. So if I put on some fits that assume the self-similar slope, you get this. You can see that they seem to go through all the points of the appropriate color reasonably well, and there is a vertical shift between them. That wasn't imposed. That's the measurement. If you allow those slopes to vary, and I've plotted that on in a dotted line, you can see that the R500 points, the blue ones, prefer a shallower slope. But actually, the statistical difference between these is not significant. The R2500 data points, which are better constrained, you can't actually see both lines because they're right on top of each other. It's very consistent with self-similar. The intrinsic scatter in these populations at R2500 is about 18%, and at R500 is about 24%. I'd say it's about 20%. The numbers are consistent with each other, which is larger than what you'd hope for between max and y. But there's more to say about that.
So Dan? So
yes.
The weak lensing error bars?
What happened? There you go. Weak lensing error bars, yes.
Do those include the intrinsic scatter due to large scale structure?
No. That's a couple slides from now I'm going to point out that there are other sources of scatter here that are not accounted for. And so one other thing you can do is if you assume the self-similar scaling relation, so you work in this normalization difference between R500 and R2500, and then fit them all together, you can see that they actually lie pretty well on the same line, and this slope here is consistent with self-similarity as well. And these dotted lines are the width of the intrinsic scatter. So, what do we have? Well, this is the first weak lensing mass y scaling relation, the first scaling relation between mass and y that's not assuming hydrostatic equilibrium. We find that it's consistent with self-similarity at both radii, or when you if you impose self-similarity, you find a very good fit. Chi squared is perfectly acceptable. The scatter is larger than the theoretical, but as Gil said, we have not yet accounted for some very important things, particularly at these large radii. One thing is that there's significant projected mass scatter, and to some extent SZ, although your papers and Laurie's papers, I think, suggest that we probably don't have to worry about SZ scatter for most of these masses. This is at R500, we're talking about 2 10 to the 14 for the lowest mass cluster. So these are pretty massive clusters.
Did you find it was more self-similar for the smaller radii for R2500?
We did find that they're both consistent with self-similarity, but it's perfectly consistent with self-similar for the sample. The dashed is free slope, and the solid is letting the slope, is fixing the slope self-similar. You can see they lie right on top of each other. Here they're different.
It's kind of counterintuitive, actually. We think it's more self-similar as you go to R500, which encompasses more mass.
I think that the problem here is that at R500, we have a bigger problem with projected mass than we do at R2500. And so there's a lot more unaccounted for scatter at R500. And so already these two are consistent. But if you start adding another systematic effect that we're not accounting for here, then I think.
If you cut that one guy out, does
that go back? I try and avoid doing things like that.
I know, but I just.
I haven't done it, but I
There's something weird with that guy's weak lens. There must be.
It's AVL383. I haven't looked at which one it is. You know, the mass looks good. The SE looks beautiful. I don't know why. Okabe's coming next month. We'll all sit and talk to him about it. It'll be fun. He'll be around for more than a week. So, and then he's going to Princeton, I think. So, anyway. So I skipped over it before, but this sample can grow when Nobuhiro comes to town. We can do a couple things. First of all, he's not giving me masses for clusters where the NFW fit isn't very good, which is fair enough. But in all cases, you have a non-parametric measure of the mass because you have a convergence map, and you can just integrate that over an area. And so in principle, we can take all 25 clusters for which we have SDA data, and look at this non-parametric mass estimate versus Ry. And so I think we will definitely do that. We also have to get a handle on both of these things. Both the SC and weak lensing, as we're doing it now, are parameterized model, and so their error bars don't fully capture the extent to which their measurements are uncertain. And so to really constrain the scatter between mass and y, we have to start accounting for these things. And now that we actually have a scaling relation, I think that it's the time to do this. And so the final thing is that we have strong lensing data for probably all of these, although I haven't checked. And so the ultimate goal here is to normalize the weak lensing profiles with the strong lensing data. And when we do that, there will be a great improvement in precision at all radii. And so, mainly because it will break some of this mass concentration degeneracy that we have. And so at that point, we should be able to better say something about the intrinsic scatter because our error bars will be getting a lot smaller. So, that was all I have on. I get to talk about anisotropy. All right. So the parenthetical part of this talk. This is the PhD thesis of Matthew Sharp, who graduated last summer. And it was motivated about the time the essay was going together, is when this paper came out. This is from Reed Head 04. I was motivated by both the BIMA and CBI results. And so this is a primary CME power spectrum as it's been time. And there's a CBI point there that sticks up well above the expected primary anisotropy. We've heard all about this from John and others, I guess. And so we thought, well, let's take the SEA. They thought before I worked with them. Let's take the SEA and let's make a measurement of this. You know, we've got, compared to BIMA, it should be a much more sensitive instrument for this purpose. There's much more bandwidth. We have more observation time to work with because we have the thing year round. And it was somewhat finer scales because we can get the dishes close together. So we're more sensitive to brightness. As it stood about the not long before Matthew was finishing, there's also this very interesting measurement that not only was the CBI excess, possibly consistent with a high sigma 8, but that the spectrum of the excess when you compared CBI at 30 gigahertz and ACBAR at 150 gigahertz was consistent with what you expect from SE power and inconsistent with what you expect from the thermal CMB. And so that was a nice suggestion that what we have here is a true SE excess. So this is the L range over which the SEA is sensitive. And this is a condensed version of the discussion of our measurement. We have 12 groups of four fields. We absolutely ignored any extra galactic catalog. We just laid them down on the sky as a function of covering RA and staying away from the galaxy as best we could. The arrangement of our observations is to observe one field and over a range of sky and then follow another field over the exact same azimuth and elevation range. Do this four times. And that allows you to difference out the ground signal. We hoped that wouldn't be important. It turned out to be important. And the reason for doing four fields in series rather than two, as is typically done, is because you take a smaller hit on your sensitivity when you're averaging over four instead of averaging over two. The total survey area is just under 2 degrees. That's wrong. I should change that. It took about 1,300 hours of SEA time spread over about a year and a half. And the typical sensitivity of the maps in any given field is about 0.12 to 0.15 when you include all SEA baselines, millijanskys. So these are very deep maps. This is our window function. We have a mean of about an L of 4,000. You can see that it's broad, though. It's from about 3,000 to 6,000 encompasses 68% of the sensitivity. The thing that we spent much of John's talk discussing, and it's worth discussing some more, is that the primary non-CMB, non-SE source of anisotropy in these measurements is radio sources. And their contribution increases like L squared. And so we have to be careful to remove them properly, at least L squared, as long as they're not so many that they're clustered.
Or resolved,
yes. But I don't think that's too much of an issue. All we need to know is where they are, for the same reason that CBI only needs to know where they are. We're just going to project out any power associated with that position on the sky. It costs us some sensitivity, but it prevents us from needing to know the fluxes. And one thing that I think actually came from John at AAAS a couple of years ago is that if you just project out one source at each position, you're actually not accounting for the fact. You have to assume some spectral index given our broad bandwidth and their broad bandwidth. And so in order to ensure that we're not leaving residual power from sources that have different spectral indices than whatever we've assumed, we project out three sources of different spectral index at each position, costing us a little more sensitivity, but ensuring that there's not some residual power at one end of our frequencies or the other that's not projected out. Now, how do we identify sources for rejection? Well, we have a couple different techniques. The one that was our primary technique and hoped for only necessary technique was to use the SEA long and short baselines together to identify radio sources directly from our data. It's fairly sensitive. We can detect them down to 600 microjanskis and project those out. But we know that that's not going to detect everything, and so we took 100 hours or so, now it's 75, of VLA time to survey all of our fields at 8 gigahertz very deeply, 30 microjanskis, in the hope that even in very inverted sources that might appear at 30 gigahertz but not appear in, say, NBSS, would be detected at 8 gigahertz in this sensitive survey. And this is to get sources that are just below our detection limit, but still carry an important amount of power. There are two fields that we don't have 8 gigahertz data for, and then we had to resort to NBSS in first, which is 1.4 gigahertz. We estimate our residual power from simulations, and the key input here is the number of sources as a function of flux. And we have the deepest measurement of VNBS, as it's called, at 30 gigahertz that has yet been made, because we surveyed 6 square degrees with the SCA to fairly high sensitivity, and we surveyed a couple square degrees to even higher sensitivity for the anisotropy measurement. And so we have a couple hundred sources between these surveys going down to this detection of about 600 microjanskis. And so we measure DNDS and just need to extrapolate it a little further, and we do this by a power law fit. And as an independent check, we use sort of the standard multi-frequency synthesis radio source model from Dezzati et al. As another simulation source. And in both cases, the estimated contribution for undetected radio sources below our very low detection limit is small. It's only 20 microcase. And so we think we've done a very good job of removing these sources. As is standard in CMB analyses, you can split your data into two halves that are supposed to be identical, and if you difference them, you should get rid of all sky power, and it can reveal things that are instrumental in origin that that you might not have noticed in the data themselves. And this proved to us that we needed to do ground subtraction. Without ground subtraction, we absolutely could not get this frequency jackknife to come out reasonably. We're differencing, we have 16 bands, and we're differencing alternating bands. And so for astronomical reasons, this is a somewhat difficult thing to pass anyway, because sources aren't flat across those bands. But nevertheless, it was failing badly before we introduced the ground subtraction. So those are the jackknife results. If I reveal the unjackknife data, you see it looks like a jackknife result itself. We don't see a lot of power. And this is the origin of all the discussion, given that these papers, Severs et al. And Sharp et al. Came out on AstroPH on the very same day and the day after the Quad paper. It's strange how that happened, isn't it?
You would have come out that week no matter what.
Okay.
it's called stimulated submission.
It really was. It really was. The fact that I shared office with the first author Quad paper is clear how that stimulation happened. Less clear how this action at a distance happened for the ZBI. Anyway, so this is the figure that's in our paper. I have not updated it for the new results that appeared on the same day. John just gave me the numbers, but I don't have the window function, so I couldn't update the bottom here, so I said screw it. Anyway, you see the CBI results from Rehead 04, and you see the FIMA result, which, as Bill will say, was actually really an upper limit on the power. It's a little more than one sigma detection, but you have to account for the non-Gaussian AMD as well. And then this is our new result here, the FCA, with tiny error bars, which is nice. That was our original motivation. So what's in this power? Oh, that's a good number. We have a zero sign. Yeah. All right, I'll get through this quick. What's in this number? Well, we know that although we're pretty far from the primary CMB is this dashed line here, our window function has some sensitivity to the primary CMB, and it's not an insignificant amount. It's about 26 microk² I already said the undetected radio source power, and then we estimated some contamination signals, this is an absolute hard upper limit. This is an extreme outlier in the amount you expect from spinning dust in these fields. Almost every other normalization of the relationship between IRS power and microwave power suggests sort of one microcase for it. So we don't subtract this out at all. We think that this is just saying that it can't be very much. And so if you subtract all these things out, you end up with a very small amount of power from SEM isotropy. And if you integrate up our likelihood, you find that our upper limit at 95% confidence is about 150 microcase per. So what does this say about sigma 8? Well, we did not take any analytic model as a way to estimate sigma 8. Our original idea was that we would look at a bunch of simulations, feed them through our observations, make simulated observations of them, and convert between the simulation sigma 8 and the power we observe, and directly infer sigma 8 for our observed power. It turned out that we looked at four different sets of simulations. These black points are all from Gill, and then these are Laurie's. And then I put it here, White et al. and Schultz and White.
What is the physics in the simulation?
What's that?
What kind of physics do you simulate?
It varies. But I think there's not that much of it. But I think the point we came away with is that they vary by a lot, right? These are the same sigma 8, these are the same sigma 8, these are the same sigma 8. And they disagree with each other very strongly. The error bars here are what we expect in observations of the type we observe. So it includes the variance from observing 44 fields rather than the whole sky. And so this gray band here is our actual measurement, and we don't feel that we can put much constraint at all from sigma 8, at least for these simulations, given the current state of simulations as we've been discussing yesterday and today. I think that's where I'm stopping. Yes. So negative 5. Do you have that sign?
I should have.
Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you.
One quick question then?
Before we break for lunch.
The triangle and has cooling and star formation, or are all of these actually just pure adiabatic or non-radiative?
No, all of these are.
So, I actually know exactly what's in. So mine is just a extended, like a Halo catalog based on Pinocchio with Ian McCarthy's gas models painted on. The Laurie's one.
What goes into the gas model? That's where
so
I get lost.
You know, it's some entropy floor.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Fed into NFW halos, and with some description for evolving it. You know, it's a spherical cow of some kind. So Laurie's one is presumably the Bodine Ostreicher model.
Yes.
And
the
Laurie's
Schultz and White is, I think, just a hydro simulation with no
cooling and physics.